This is the University of Cambridge Local Examination Syndicate International General Certificate of Secondary Education November 2000 examination in English as a Second Language. Paper 3. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you're doing the test. The tape should now be stopped and the papers handed out. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. Zara is travelling to England to stay with a friend. Which very important item is her mother reminding her to take?
Don't forget to say goodbye to your grandmother, and most important of all, remember your passport. Don't forget to say goodbye to your grandmother, and most important of all, remember your passport.
Question 2. John is suggesting to Peter a way of saving money. What other advantage will they gain by cycling to college?
Why don't we cycle to college tomorrow instead of taking the bus? It will certainly keep us fit and save us money. Why don't we cycle to college tomorrow instead of taking the bus? It will certainly keep us fit and save us money.
Question 3. Carl has hurt his elbow and has asked to see the doctor. Why will he have to wait for treatment?
I think I may have sprained my elbow. I need to see Dr. Kuczynska immediately.
I'm afraid that the doctor has been called to an emergency, so you'll have to wait some time.
I think I may have sprained my elbow. I need to see Dr. Kuczynska immediately.
I'm afraid that the doctor has been called to an emergency, so you'll have to wait some time.
Question 4. Kerry has seen an advertisement for an office job and is telephoning the company. In what department does she hope to work? And when exactly are the interviews being held?
Hello, is that Smith & Company? I'm telephoning about the job you advertised for a secretary in the sales department.
Ah, yes. We're holding interviews on Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. If you can wait a moment, I'll get my appointment book and take your details.
Thank you. Hello, is that Smith & Company? I'm telephoning about the job you advertised for a secretary in the sales department.
Ah, yes. We're holding interviews on Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. If you can wait a moment, I'll get my appointment book and take your details.
Thank you.
Question 5. Jim and Mary are talking about television. Why does Jim think it's a good idea for them to buy a second TV?
Jim, we're always arguing about what programmes to watch on television. You always want to watch football, and I don't.
Okay, let's buy another TV. Then you can watch your favourite wildlife programmes.
Jim, we're always arguing about what programmes to watch on television. You always want to watch football, and I don't.
Okay, let's buy another TV. Then you can watch your favourite wildlife programmes.
Question 6. Tandy is hoping to buy a theatre ticket at half the normal price for next Monday's performance. Why is it not possible to do so immediately?
Good morning, Capital Theatre. How may I help you?
I want to buy a half-price ticket for next Monday's performance.
I'm afraid that the half-price tickets are only sold on the day of the performance. We open at 10 each morning. Good morning, Capital Theatre. How may I help you?
I want to buy a half-price ticket for next Monday's performance.
I'm afraid that the half-price tickets are only sold on the day of the performance. We open at 10 each morning.
That is the last question in part one. Listen to the following interview with Shanta Carlson, a marine biologist at the London Aquarium. Then complete the notes below. You will hear the interview twice.
And welcome to Wildlife World, our weekly survey of news and views about the animal kingdom. Each week we begin the show with an item about careers working with animals. And today we're delighted to have someone who works at the London Aquarium with us in the studio. Shanta Carlson, it's good to meet you, and welcome to Wildlife World.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Tell me, did you always want to be a marine biologist?
No, but I've always loved the sea, living by it all my life.
Did you go to college?
I studied at Southampton University, where I did a degree in oceanography with biology. After that, I did a one-year course in marine resource development and protection. I really wanted to get into protecting the sea, and the course was about environmental management of the sea.
What about your working day?
Well, I start at about 9 a.m. There's a lot of maintenance to be done, like checking the systems, the water filtration, and feeding the 350 different species of fish we house. There are 10 of us doing this job at the aquarium, and we're all on a rota. Sometimes I talk to people by the rock pool, or go diving in the big tanks with the tropical and Pacific sharks, which I love doing. I generally finish at 6 p.m., but these are live animals and their needs come before yours. If there's more work to do, you have to stay late. I always get 2 days off a week, but I have to work 2 weekends in 3.
What do you like about your job?
Being in the tanks with the sharks. The biggest shark is as big as me, but it's not dangerous, because these animals are used to eating fish, not humans. I can see the visitors watching me, and it's exciting to see the looks on their faces as the sharks cruise past you.
And is there anything you don't like?
The worst part of my job is early on a Monday, getting into the cold tanks in a diving suit. I have to clean the tanks when the water is almost freezing.
What about your future, say in 10 years' time?
There are several routes I could take. I could end up being a fish curator, who decides where fish go and what type of fish we have in a museum or aquarium. On the other hand, I'm really interested in teaching, so I might get more into the educational side of marine biology.
How much holiday do you have?
I get 20 days per year, which isn't bad considering it's not as if I take my work home with me in the evenings. I don't even have a fish tank at home.
What about earnings?
I don't earn much. But the greatest thing about this job is not the earnings, but the fact it's such an international thing. There are lots of possibilities of travel.
It sounds as if you have a fascinating job. Shanta Carlson, thank you very much for coming in to talk to us.
Now you will hear the interview again.
And welcome to Wildlife World, our weekly survey of news and views about the animal kingdom. Each week we begin the show with an item about careers working with animals. And today we're delighted to have someone who works at the London Aquarium with us in the studio. Shanta Carlson, it's good to meet you, and welcome to Wildlife World.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Tell me, did you always want to be a marine biologist?
No, but I've always loved the sea, living by it all my life.
Did you go to college?
I studied at Southampton University, where I did a degree in oceanography with biology. After that, I did a one-year course in marine resource development and protection. I really wanted to get into protecting the sea, and the course was about environmental management of the sea.
What about your working day?
Well, I start at about 9 a.m. There's a lot of maintenance to be done, like checking the systems, the water filtration, and feeding the 350 different species of fish we house. There are 10 of us doing this job at the aquarium, and we're all on a rota. Sometimes I talk to people by the rock pool, or go diving in the big tanks with the tropical and Pacific sharks, which I love doing. I generally finish at 6 p.m., but these are live animals, and their needs come before yours. If there's more work to do, you have to stay late. I always get 2 days off a week, but I have to work 2 weekends in 3.
What do you like about your job?
Being in the tanks with the sharks. The biggest shark is as big as me, but it's not dangerous, because these animals are used to eating fish, not humans. I can see the visitors watching me, and it's exciting to see the looks on their faces as the sharks cruise past you.
And is there anything you don't like?
The worst part of my job is early on a Monday, getting into the cold tanks in a diving suit. I have to clean the tanks when the water is almost freezing.
What about your future, say in 10 years' time?
There are several routes I could take. I could end up being a fish curator, who decides where fish go and what type of fish we have in a museum or aquarium. On the other hand, I'm really interested in teaching, so I might get more into the educational side of marine biology.
How much holiday do you have?
I get 20 days per year, which isn't bad considering it's not as if I take my work home with me in the evenings. I don't even have a fish tank at home.
What about earnings?
I don't earn much. But the greatest thing about this job is not the earnings, but the fact it's such an international thing. There are lots of possibilities of travel.
It sounds as if you have a fascinating job. Shanta Carlson, thank you very much for coming in to talk to us.
A school group is taking part in an activity holiday. The group leader is telling the students what they will be doing that week. Listen to what he says, and then complete the diary page. You will hear his speech twice.
Welcome to the activity week, everyone. The idea of the holiday is to let everyone try a new sport and sample a range of activities under the guidance of friendly, qualified instructors. The emphasis for the week will always be on fun and enjoyment. Our first activity will begin on Monday morning at 9:30, when we'll be going horse riding along a pleasant river path and into open countryside. meet at the reception desk. All the specialist gear you need will be provided, so you don't need to bring anything. Could those with some previous experience of horse riding put their hands up? Ah, thank you. On Monday evening at 8 p.m, there will be a welcome party in the dining room, where you can meet up and get to know each other over coffee and biscuits. Tuesday morning is devoted to water sports of one kind or another, including windsurfing, canoeing, and sailing in small dinghies. Check your particular group by looking at the list on the notice board. On Tuesday afternoon, there's an opportunity to learn climbing. The first hour will be devoted to a lecture by Mr. Danda on climbing practice and safety. Then, you'll be doing some gentle rock climbing yourselves. The spectacular views you'll get are certainly worth the climb. On Wednesday, we'll start the day with a session on map reading skills. In the afternoon, we'll be going on a long walk across the hills to test those newly acquired map reading skills. Oh, the scenery is really dramatic, so it's well worth bringing a camera if you've got one. You can stop and take photographs whenever you like. On Thursday, in the morning, there's a choice of end-of-holiday trips, such as a visit to a wildlife park, historic house, or bird-watching at a nature reserve. I'll be checking your preference later in the week, so don't worry, you don't have to decide now. We'll be returning early because there's a football match arranged for the afternoon. There will then be a farewell party and barbecue. Oh, now don't forget to put your suitcases by the front door immediately after the football match, as we'll be leaving for home straight after the barbecue. Well, hope you've managed to get all that down. Are there any questions? No? Well, then thank you for listening. I hope you have a great holiday.
Now you will hear the group leader's speech again.
Welcome to the activity week, everyone. The idea of the holiday is to let everyone try a new sport and sample a range of activities under the guidance of friendly, qualified instructors. The emphasis for the week will always be on fun and enjoyment. Our first activity will begin on Monday morning at 9:30, when we'll be going horse riding along a pleasant river path and into open countryside. Meet at the reception desk. All the specialist gear you need will be provided, so you don't need to bring anything. Could those with some previous experience of horse riding put their hands up? Ah, thank you. On Monday evening at 8 p.m, there will be a welcome party in the dining room, where you can meet up and get to know each other over coffee and biscuits. Tuesday morning is devoted to water sports of one kind or another, including windsurfing, canoeing, and sailing in small dinghies. Check your particular group by looking at the list on the notice board. On Tuesday afternoon, there's an opportunity to learn climbing. The first hour will be devoted to a lecture by Mr. Danda on climbing practice and safety. Then, you'll be doing some gentle rock climbing yourselves. The spectacular views you'll get are certainly worth the climb. On Wednesday, we'll start the day with a session on map reading skills. In the afternoon, we'll be going on a long walk across the hills to test those newly acquired map reading skills. Oh, the scenery is really dramatic, so it's well worth bringing a camera if you've got one. You can stop and take photographs whenever you like. On Thursday, in the morning, there's a choice of end-of-holiday trips, such as a visit to a wildlife park, historic house,
or bird watching at a nature reserve. I'll be checking your preference later in the week, so don't worry. You don't have to decide now. We'll be returning early because there's a football match arranged for the afternoon. There will then be a farewell party and barbecue. Oh, now don't forget to put your suitcases by the front door immediately after the football match, as we'll be leaving for home straight after the barbecue. Well, hope you've managed to get all that down. Are there any questions? No? Well, then thank you for listening. I hope you have a great holiday.
Listen to the following radio interview with a postman in the countryside. Then indicate whether each statement is true or false by putting a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
Today we're going to hear about the life of a countryside postman. Norman Dunbar, welcome to the studio. Tell me, are countryside communities on your postal round changing?
Not really, no. There are no real communities, just remote farmhouses where the same families have been for generations. They are miles from anywhere, and there are no shops or near neighbours. I've got to know just about everyone, and I speak to them most days.
Mm. Do you feel that you've become part of their lives?
Well, after a few years, yes, I begin to. You know when they are ill, when they are well, when old ones have died, and when babies are due.
Would you be happy for someone to swap post routes with you?
Put it this way, I'd fight to keep my route. But every few years a more senior person arrives, and he or she has the choice of the best job. So far, they haven't wanted to take my job. It wouldn't suit everyone.
You sound as though you look forward to going to work.
Oh, yes, I do enjoy seeing these people. I've a little school on my postal round. I think it must be the smallest in the region, with just 12 children in it. Mm-hmm. They all know me. In such isolated places, people always have time to talk. You can find you're running late if you've been having a chat, but it doesn't matter to me.
Can you briefly describe your day's routine?
The sorting office is only a short distance from my house. I start sorting mail at 0500 hours, and I'll be doing this for an hour. You get the mail for your own round and sort it before starting off. The van is parked outside the office. I finish delivering the mail at 1100 hours, and then set off for home. I'm back in the town by lunchtime.
And do you deliver the mail when it snows heavily?
I get as far as I can. I often follow the snow plough, but I've once been stuck in thick snow until late afternoon, before a farmer pulled me out. Huh? I always carry waterproofs, a thick coat, and a spade just in case. You don't need a lot of snow to stop the van on steep bits. If it looks as if it's an important letter, I'll walk there.
Do postmen in the countryside get remembered well at Christmas time?
Oh, very. I'm given everything from money to chocolates, puddings and turkeys. Most people give me something. They don't so much in towns, because they don't really know their postman as they do out in the countryside.
Imagine you won a large amount of money in a competition. Would it change your life?
I've sometimes wondered what I'd do in a situation like that. But I love this job, and I can't see myself giving it up.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Today we're going to hear about the life of a countryside postman. Norman Dunbar, welcome to the studio. Tell me, are countryside communities on your postal round changing?
Not really, no. There are no real communities, just remote farmhouses where the same families have been for generations. They are miles from anywhere, and there are no shops or near neighbours. I've got to know just about everyone, and I speak to them most days.
Mm. Do you feel that you've become part of their lives?
Well, after a few years, yes, I begin to. You know when they are ill, when they are well, when old ones have died, and when babies are due.
Would you be happy for someone to swap post routes with you?
Put it this way, I'd fight to keep my route. But every few years a more senior person arrives, and he or she has the choice of the best job.
Oh.
So far they haven't wanted to take my job. It wouldn't suit everyone.
You sound as though you look forward to going to work.
Oh, yes, I do enjoy seeing these people. I've a little school on my postal round. I think it must be the smallest in the region, with just 12 children in it.
Mm-hmm.
They all know me. In such isolated places, people always have time to talk. You can find you're running late if you've been having a chat, but it doesn't matter to me.
Can you briefly describe your day's routine?
The sorting office is only a short distance from my house. I start sorting mail at 0500 hours, and I'll be doing this for an hour. You get the mail for your own round and sort it before starting off. The van is parked outside the office. I finish delivering the mail at 1100 hours, and then set off for home. I'm back in the town by lunchtime.
And do you deliver the mail when it snows heavily?
I get as far as I can. I often follow the snow plough, but I've once been stuck in thick snow until late afternoon, before a farmer pulled me out.
Huh?
I always carry waterproofs, a thick coat, and a spade just in case. You don't need a lot of snow to stop the van on steep bits. If it looks as if it's an important letter, I'll walk there.
Do postmen in the countryside get remembered well at Christmas time?
Oh, very. I'm given everything from money to chocolates, puddings and turkeys. Most people give me something. They don't so much in towns, because they don't really know their postman as they do out in the countryside.
Imagine you won a large amount of money in a competition. Would it change your life?
I've sometimes wondered what I'd do in a situation like that. But I love this job, and I can't see myself giving it up.
Listen to this talk by Ahmed Hassan on the Sahara Marathon race. Then indicate whether each statement is true or false by putting a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the talk twice.
In the Saharan sands of southern Morocco, 500 runners line up tomorrow for the toughest foot race in the world. We welcome Ahmed Hassan, who is going to tell us all about it.
The Sahara Marathon race covers 240 kilometres in 7 days, the equivalent of about 6 marathons. The terrain is not smooth city tarmac, but rocks and riverbeds, and, worst of all, 180-metre sand dunes which slip and slide underfoot. Temperatures reach as high as 48 degrees Celsius, and competitors must carry their food, bedding, and cooking equipment for the week. Their survival kits include blister repair kits, sun cream, dried food, and a pump to extract venom from bites. And they each pay $3,500 for the privilege of running. The race organizer, who ran 400 kilometers through the desert 13 years ago, claims, and here I'm quoting from a written account, "The desert
communicated with me, and a sandstorm transported me to a dream world. Runners arrive at the medical tents at the end of each day with huge blisters. Then they must sleep under tents in the cold before the next day's run. The marathon has 6 stages, with the toughest day having 80 kilometers to cover, and the last day involving a 20-kilometer sprint home. Last year, Lachen Hanal from Morocco took a total of 17 hours, 19 minutes, and 58 seconds, more than half an hour ahead of the next runner. The route, which runners are told only at the start of each day, has checkpoints where they can pick up their daily allocation of 9 liters of water and supplies. They must navigate themselves. 2 years ago, one runner went missing for 9 days and only just survived, nearly dying of thirst. Another died of a heart attack. Further risks include poisonous snakes and sandstorms. Among the runners this year are bankers, soldiers, cab drivers, hairdressers, teachers, and a radio sports reporter. Almost everyone is running to raise money for charity.
Ahmed Hassan, thank you for your most interesting talk.
Now you will hear the talk again.
In the Saharan sands of southern Morocco, 500 runners line up tomorrow for the toughest foot race in the world. We welcome Ahmed Hassan, who is going to tell us all about it.
The Sahara Marathon race covers 240 kilometers in 7 days, the equivalent of about 6 marathons. The terrain is not smooth city tarmac, but rocks and riverbeds, and, worst of all, 180-meter sand dunes which slip and slide underfoot. Temperatures reach as high as 48 degrees Celsius, and competitors must carry their food, bedding, and cooking equipment for the week. Their survival kits include blister repair kits, sun cream, dried food, and a pump to extract venom from bites. And they each pay $3,500 for the privilege of running. The race organizer, who ran 400 kilometers through the desert 13 years ago, claims, and here I'm quoting from a written account, "The desert communicated with me, and a sandstorm transported me to a dream world." Runners arrive at the medical tents at the end of each day with huge blisters. Then they must sleep under tents in the cold before the next day's run. The marathon has 6 stages, with the toughest day having 80 kilometers to cover, and the last day involving a 20-kilometer sprint home. Last year, Lachen Hanal from Morocco took a total of 17 hours, 19 minutes, and 58 seconds, more than half an hour ahead of the next runner. The route, which runners are told only at the start of each day, has checkpoints where they can pick up their daily allocation of 9 liters of water and supplies. They must navigate themselves. 2 years ago, one runner went missing for 9 days and only just survived, nearly dying of thirst. Another died of a heart attack. Further risks include poisonous snakes and sandstorms. Among the runners this year are bankers, soldiers, cab drivers, hairdressers, teachers, and a radio sports reporter. Almost everyone is running to raise money for charity.
Ahmed Hassan, thank you for your most interesting talk.